any complaints from within the party, and the rather half-hearted cover to a widely known reality seems more a matter of preserving conventions than anything else. Stalin seems, in fact, to have issued official instructions on torture proper as early as the beginning of 1937, though they remained confidential even from provincial party secretaries until he confirmed the orders, both retrospectively and prospectively, in the secret telegram to them on January 20, 1939 when, after the fall of Yazov, one or two objectors had begun to make themselves heard, see here. Several victims note that the NKVD respected certain formalities. Of course, their methods of interrogation were a clear breach of the law. But declarations signed by prisoners were very rarely suppressed. They had to be copied and filed in the dossier. So when Beria took over, he found that some prosecutors were still attaching the complaints made by the accused about illegal methods of investigation to the examination record. He took this up with Vyshinsky, who gave instructions that it was not to occur again, though in some cases the prisoner's statements could be preserved on file. 192. Not attached to the records of the case. Whichever interrogation method was applied to a given victim, the required confession followed the same routines. As early as 1931, the foundations had been fully established. A surgeon had confessed his intention to poison the Dnieper River. A lawyer had confessed first to blowing up a bridge, then to planning terrorism, and finally to being a Japanese spy. An electrical engineer was to have commanded a battery of artillery to bombard the working men's quarter of Dnipropetrovsk. Another accused confessed to having met former President Poincaré. There is a report of a former senior official in the Ukrainian timber industry who at the beginning of the 1930s had made a confession in connection with the Industrial Party trial, that he had had too little timber felled in order to spare the woods for their former owners, whose rights he aimed to restore. He had been sentenced to 10 years but released after a year and, like many members of this particular conspiracy, restored to high position. On his re-arrest, he was required to confess that he had had too much timber felled in order to ruin the forests. Another forester had had to confess that he had special tracks cut in the forests to open the way for. 194. Polish or German tanks. One typical style of charge was that against Mrs. Weisberg, arrested in April 1936. She was a ceramicist, and it was alleged that she had surreptitiously inserted swastikas into the patterns of teacups she had designed, and had hidden two pistols under her bed with a view to killing Stalin. A Jewish engineer was accused of having designed a large scientific institute in the form of half a swastika, for reasons of Nazi. 196. Ideology. A woman potter had designed an ashtray which resembled, or could be made to resemble, a Zionist Star of David. She was arrested, and the stock destroyed. Kessler mentions a German communist doctor who was charged with injecting patients with a venereal disease, spreading rumors that venereal disease was incurable, and being a German spy. Professor Bielan, of Kiev University, was charged with espionage for mentioning in a textbook the depth of the Dnieper at various points. Another professor, a Jewish refugee from Germany, had given German agents details about the navigability of the Siberian River Obi. A third had forwarded to the Japanese reports about the political attitude of Jewish children. One Kiev workman confessed to having tried to blow up a kilometer-long bridge over the Dnieper with a few kilograms of arsenic, but having had to abandon the attempt owing to rainy weather. Speaking of a middle-aged washerwoman type, accused of consorting with foreigners in expensive restaurants and seducing Soviet diplomats to worm secrets out of them, a Soviet writer bitterly comments, "This was July 1937, when no one cared any longer whether charges bore the slightest semblance of probability or not." There is a Soviet account published in Khrushchev's time of an old Bolshevik serving a 15-year sentence for terrorism, in that he had murdered himself. The NKVD maintained that he had stolen the dead man's papers and passed himself off in his place. When he had NKVD officers call a witness who had known him since childhood, and identified him at once, they threw her out and sentenced him notwithstanding. When a big case was afoot, local interrogators sometimes tried to gain credit by finding accomplices for it, on their own initiative, among their prisoners. After the Tukhachevsky case, a junior interrogator attempted to involve Weisberg in a connection with the Reichswehr, to build up a new military conspiracy. His superior, on the other hand, meant to produce Weisberg as a witness in the Bukharin trial, a role to which he was better suited, since he had at least met Bukharin. There is an account of a case in the Ukraine in which 50 students were charged with forming an organization to assassinate Kosyr, who had been named as one of the senior intended victims in the Great Moscow Trials. A year's work on this case, which was a structure of great intricacy, had been performed by the interrogators. In 1938, however, It became known that Kosior himself had been arrested as a Trotskyite. Everyone thought that the students would be released. But a new interrogation immediately started, and they were beaten up for having lied to the NKVD. After a few days, the steel pigeons in the cells let them know what they were supposed to confess this time. It was to change their deposition, putting in the name of Kaganovich for that of Kosior. The NKVD could not face the trouble of constructing a completely new fabrication. Finally, everything was in order. 204. And the students were sent off to labor camps. Trademark. The demand for denunciation was a difficult matter of conscience with many. One Armenian priest with a good memory confessed to recruiting all his countrymen he had buried in the past 3 years. A newly arrested prisoner would sometimes find a list of unused dead men made available by. 205. His cellmates. The denunciation of people already arrested and sentenced was not regarded as discreditable. But, of course, such tactics only seldom satisfied the examiners, and most people gave way enough to implicate outside contacts whose names were presented to them as already suspect by the very fact of acquaintance. On the whole, the NKVD officer showed a niggling, self-righteous, and bureaucratic brutality, treating the prisoners like cattle about whom any question of sympathy simply did not arise. But there are many reports of odd exceptions, showing that even in these circumstances the Russian style of humanism sporadically persisted. Two ex-prisoners note. There were many officials of all grades, from simple warder to prison governor, who again and again defied regulations and risked their own freedom by finding opportunities of making prisoners' lives easier by secretly giving them food or cigarettes, or even merely speaking a cheering and comforting word to them. Yosef Lengyel, however, recounts that though he remembers humane guards and decent commandants, the investigators were without. 207. Exception despicable. This minor divergence certainly reflects the increasing brutalization of the NKVD. Kostas Glitkin, even, is a figure of the Agoda rather than the Azov period. An NKVD sentry was returning a prisoner to his cell, after an interrogation in the Butyrka. They stopped at a tap for the prisoner to wash the blood off himself. As he did this, he was shaken with sobs. The sentry said, "Don't take it too hard, comrade. Life's hard on us all, one just has to bear it. Maybe he did beat you for no good reason, but think nothing of it. Probably his black heart aches more than your white body. You can wash the blood off just like that, but what about him? Where's the water that can clean his black heart?" The prisoner, an army officer named Vasilov, returned to his cell much cheered, and spoke of the special humanity of the Russian people. Trademark. A woman prisoner, a German communist, reports a guard on the deportation train as saying to her, when she was in tears, "Don't cry. It won't be as bad as all that. You live through it and get home again." She was later, when handed over to the Nazis, to note in the same way the occasional kind and thoughtful Gestapo man. Eugenia Ginsburg tells a similar story. In 1937, though this is a somewhat different point, some of the old NKVD officers continued to show sympathy for obviously innocent and non-oppositionist old Bolsheviks. A Soviet account by Antonina Levkovich, who was arrested as the wife of an enemy of the people in 1937 following an appeal for her already arrested husband, quotes several instances of kindness. They often turned out badly for all concerned. After a month spent in bad conditions on the way from Moscow to Kyrgyzstan, she and her companions found an NKVD officer who tried to save them from starvation. He was charged with intolerable pity for wives of enemies of the people and had to shoot himself to avoid arrest. Such things are worth recording. But at the best of times, they were most exceptional. The norm was callous brutality, or at best cloddish indifference to death and suffering. A Soviet writer remarks of the interrogators, "They were all sadists, of course. And only a handful found the courage to commit suicide. Pace by pace, as they followed one routine directive after another, they climbed down the steps from the human condition to that of beasts. But this happened only gradually. The few humane officers and guards did not anyhow survive Yazov's purge of the NKVD. His new intake of NKVD troopers were well-trained, well-fed, heartless young thugs. Any display of human sympathy, they had firmly implanted in them, was a concession to bourgeois feeling and a form of treachery in the class struggle. As the purge broadened, it also got worse. Trial. With interrogation completed, the cases were transferred to the judicial and quasi-judicial bodies for sentence. Since 1934, the competent court in political cases was the military collegium of the Supreme Court. It had a large staff and was able to mount many cases simultaneously. It took mere minutes even for leading officials, see here, or generals, see here. A lesser figure, Eugenia Ginsburg, describes her 7-minute trial before the Collegium in 1937. The court returned in 2 minutes with a verdict which she estimates must have taken 20 minutes to type. Thus the Collegium got through tens of thousands of cases over the years of the Terror. From October 1, 1936 to September 30, 1938, it passed 36,157 sentences, 30,514 of death and 5,643 of imprisonment. But these constituted a very small proportion of those condemned. Those who came before a court were judged according to the Criminal Code, whose long Article 58 covered all forms of remotely political crime. This article was broad enough, or so it might have been thought, to encompass anyone the NKVD wished to repress. And it had long been draconically interpreted. A Supreme Court ruling of January 2, 1928 had laid down that counter-revolutionary offenses were committed when the person who committed them, although not directly pursuing a counter-revolutionary aim, wittingly entertained the possibility of this arising or should have foreseen the socially dangerous character of the consequences of his actions. Trademark equals the definition of terrorism was gradually extended to violent acts against a wide range of people. Not only all party officials, but also members of grain procurement commissions, in 1930, shock workers, in 1931, and pioneers, in 1934, were covered. A law of August 7, 1932 introduced the death penalty for a wide range of offenses against state property, and the courts seem to have been invited to extend it still further in practical action. Again, to take an example from the field of sabotage, a law of August 1935 established as such the gleaning of wheat by peasant women, who had hitherto been able to save a certain amount in this way. Peasant women were commonly given 10 years. 218. For this offense, Vyshinsky strengthened such tendencies by a simple interpretive method. He proposed that the deliberate burning of state or public property be adjudicated, regardless of motive and intent, under Article 58, Paragraph 9, of the Russian Republic Criminal Codex, sabotage. Consequently, acts committed without counter-revolutionary intent, for instance, arson for reasons of personal enmity, revenge, etc., had to be adjudicated under the articles on state crimes. Vyshinsky declared that there are no ordinary criminal offenses, that these offenses now became crimes of a political order. He recommended that ordinary criminal cases be reviewed for the purpose of imparting a political character to them. To take a specific crime, Vyshinsky demanded that counter-revolutionary intent must mandatorily be sought in all criminal cases linked with shortcomings connected with the harvesting campaign. In his view, shortcomings in the harvesting campaign were in many cases caused by the activity of saboteurs, who had to be rendered harmless. For example, during the harvesting campaign of 1937, it was revealed that a number of crops had become infested with ticks. This infection was ascribed to the activity of hostile counter-revolutionary elements, and in connection with this a great number of criminal cases were instituted. Many of the indictments linked with tick infection in grain crops were completely unfounded. Yet Vyshinsky demanded that the prosecutors insist on severe punishment in all criminal cases instituted in connection with crops infested with ticks. When it came to the actual trial, he repeatedly maintained that in a criminal trial probability of guilt was perfectly adequate. Instructing prosecutors in the art of identifying saboteurs, Vyshinsky maintained that this is achieved not by comprehensive, full and objective evaluation of the evidence gathered in a criminal case, but by so-called political flair. And the legal processes were eased by his ruling that it is pointless to repeat without particular need what has already been established in the preliminary investigation. As a result, we get such extraordinary results as a woman who got 10 years under Article 58, Section 10, for saying, after his arrest, that Tukhachevsky was handsome, or an artist getting 5 years for adding to the slogan "Life has become better, life has become more joyful," Stalin a letter U, changing the meaning of "life has become better," for Stalin. Trademark failure to inform, treated as complicity, was severely dealt with. In a minor case, only producing a 6-year sentence even for the principal, the not informer got 3 years under Article 58, 12. Under the same article, a man was sentenced to 3 years for smiling in sympathy while some drunken dockers at another table in Odessa were telling one another anti-Soviet anecdotes. A Tatar woman, originally listed as a Trotskyite, was reallocated as a bourgeois nationalist by the NKVD official concerned, on the grounds that they'd exceeded the quota for Trotskyites, but were short on nationalists, even though they'd taken all the Tatar writers they could think of. A 20-year-old mathematician, with no political interests, was sentenced simply because his mother, an old socialist revolutionary, was rounded up in 1937. He had actually been born in a Tsarist jail. Court procedures were at best formalities. Still, the Supreme Court and its military collegium at least required the presence of the accused, though as a leading Bulgarian communist victim notes of a session of the collegium which sentenced him, no prosecutor. No witnesses. No co-accused. No defender. But comparatively few cases were dealt with by a court. Article 8 of the Corrective Labor Codex states, persons are directed to corrective labor who have been sentenced thereto by, a, sentence in a court of law, b, decree of an administrative organ. This latter was usually the NKVD Special Board, as set up by laws of 10th of July and November 5, 1934, replacing the Judicial Collegium of the Ogpu. The Special Board consisted of the deputy head of the NKVD, the plenipotentiary of the NKVD of the RSFSR, the head of the main administration of militia, and the head of the Union Republic NKVD where the case had arisen. The prosecutor general of the USSR or his 230 deputy was also to participate. The special board's sentences were originally limited to 5 years, but this was either abolished or ignored fairly soon. Terms of 8 and 10 years are soon mentioned. But in any case, while a man who served out a term imposed by a court was often released, one sentenced by the board was simply resentenced to a further period when his sentence expired. The formalities were completed in Moscow, and the new sentence was announced to the accused in camp by a local representative of the NKVD. The special board was usually given cases for which the evidence was not sufficient for turning the defendant over to a court. The defendant had no right to defense, and cases were tried in absentia, which, as a Soviet law journal has remarked, created the preconditions for deliberately passing unjustified, harsh sentences. And if the criminal code was interpreted with great elasticity by the courts, even that was found too restrictive for most cases before the special board. Article 58 was generally cited as a basis, but the accused were liable under the following heads. KRTD counter-revolutionary Trotskyite activity usual sentence 5 to 10 years KRD counter-revolutionary activity usual sentence 5 years or more K. RA counter-revolutionary agitation usual sentence 5 years or more CH.S.I.R. Member of the family of a traitor to the fatherland usual sentence 5 to 8 years P. SH. Suspicion of espionage. Usual sentence 8 years. The last an offense perhaps unique in the world's legal history. In addition, those in the following categories could be simply labeled by the prosecutor and sent to camp without even the special board routine. SOE socially dangerous element usual sentence 5 years. SVE socially harmful element, that is, common criminals 234. Usual sentence 5 years. This power to inflict punishment when there was admittedly no crime was provided for in Article 22 of the Principles of Criminal Jurisdiction, given in the Basic Criminal Code, which reads as follows. Punishment in the form of exile can be applied by a sentence of the state prosecutor against persons recognized as being socially dangerous, without any criminal proceedings being taken. Against these persons on charges of committing a specific crime or of a specific offense and, also, even in those cases where these persons are acquitted by a court of the accusation of committing a specific crime. In early 1937, sentences were still on the light side. A typical KRTD case is of an electrician arrested at that time, who had formerly known some Trotskyites and in whose room there was found, on his arrest, a copy of the first edition of the History of the Civil War, which, of course, gave many of the facts of Trotsky's role in the period covered. For this, he got 239 years. Another man, a former Trotskyite, was sentenced to a longer term. Because he had traveled from Moscow to Leningrad on December 1, 1934. Another got 3 years for possession of a KRA rhyme about Feucht, Wunger and Gide. For copying Lenin's testament, the usual sentence was 10 years, under Article 58, Section 10, for anti-Soviet agitation, though sometimes death was imposed. A professor of astronomy got 5 years, KRA, for having objected to his daughter marrying an NKVD man. Tilde a typical P.S.H. case was of a professor who had been a prisoner of war in Austria in 1915, his sole offense. The decree of 14 September 1937 established what amounted to completely extrajudicial procedures for counter-revolutionary crimes, and sentences grew greater. Moreover, those arrested in 1933 or 1935 were now retried, and the comparatively mild sentences of 3 or 5 years of those earlier days were translated into the language of 1937. After a special board trial, in his absence, the accused eventually received the sentence, on some convenient occasion. One prisoner mentioned simply being handed a grubby typewritten sheet in his cell by a woman trustee, an ex-prostitute, to the effect that the special board of the NKVD, 243, had condemned him to 5 years in camp. In spite of the vast amount of paperwork, loose ends proliferated. It is said that in the Butyrka, whole block was occupied by prisoners who could not be sent to camps because not only were there no warrants against them, but no papers of any sort existed in connection with them. They had been condemned as groups, and the judges had not been able to compile dossiers, while the labor camps would only accept prisoners with papers. The special board continued to have this legal position throughout the Stalin period. But while the board in its official form went on handing out prison sentences, though longer ones than in the previous period, a new and illegal body emerged from it. As early as March 27, 1935, a mere order of the NKVD gave the powers of the special board to committees of three NKVD officers, though a representative of the prosecutor's office was to be present at their proceedings, and they were only empowered to inflict the same sentences as the special board proper. On July 30, 1937, though this was never announced, new and deadly troikas were set up on Stalin's instructions, though on Kaganovich's initiative and formally established by a special instruction from Vyshinsky, with the power to impose the death penalty. Recalling, no doubt consciously and with a view to suggesting revolutionary urgency, the so-named emergency tribunals of the Civil War, they now in fact often, as Divak has consisted merely of two members. At the center, as we have seen, Yazhov and Vyshinsky fulfilled this role. Troikas were established in all the provinces and republics, their composition varied a little, but seems usually to have consisted of the NKVD chief as chairman, the provincial or republican first secretary, and the chairman of the local executive committee, or a representative of the prosecutor's office. A recent Soviet article tells us that in practice, the NKVD chief initialed the sentence and it was then carried out, the other two adding their initials ex post facto. As with the special board, the defendant was not present at the proceedings of the troikas. They inflicted the death penalty in absentia on a vast scale. In Uzbekistan, the Soviet press lately noted, the Republic's Troika ordered 40,000 executions in 1937 to 1938, which would mean over 1 million for the USSR as a whole. And this, of course, over and above the sentences by the Supreme Courts of the Union and Autonomous Republics, the military tribunals, and similar bodies. Moreover, executions could be carried out without even the pretense of a trial, by special order, as with G.E. Prokofiev and his subordinates in 1937 and M.S. Kedrov and others in 1941. Orders for further executions came from Moscow. Yazhov telegraphed the NKVD chief in Frunze, capital of Kyrgyzstan, "You are charged with the task of exterminating 10,000 enemies of the people. Report results by signal." The form of reply was, "In reply to yours of, the following enemies of the people have been shot," followed by a numbered list. An order to the Sverdlovsk NKVD called for 15,000 executions. Another, to a small town near Novosibirsk, ordered 500, far above normal capacity, so that the NKVD had to shoot priests and their relatives, all those who had spoken critically of conditions, amnestied former members of white armies, and so on, who would ordinarily have got 5 years or less. Tilde in February 1938, a recent Soviet account tells us, Yazhov himself went down to Kiev to call a special NKVD conference to order 30,000 more executions. 248. In the Ukraine. For all the various forms of trial, official death sentences are estimated at not over 10%. However, this is based only on the information given to relatives, and there was falsification on a large scale, with a sentence of 10 years without the right of correspondence in fact meaning execution. All the identified bodies in the mass graves at Vinnytsia and Kuropaty were of people who had had such sentences. A Soviet authority of the Khrushchev period remarked that many were exterminated without trial or investigation. Vyshinsky himself favored the extra-legal method. He several times said, "When it is a question of annihilating the enemy, we can do it just as well without a trial." There seem, in fact, to have been few executions without trial, apart from the liquidation of oppositionists already in camps, until 1937. The first blow seems to have been against foreigners resident in Russia, including naturalized Soviet citizens. With no important defenders in the party and susceptible to the charge of contact with foreign espionage, they began to go to the execution cellars in large numbers late in 1936. It was usually obvious when an execution was to take place in a central prison. Several warders and an NKVD officer would appear at the cell door, which otherwise seldom happened. There was sometimes time to say goodbye and hand over any remaining property, such as clothes, to one's cellmates. The cellars of the Lubyanka were really a sort of basement divided into a number of rooms off quarters. Later on, in ordinary routine, The condemned handed in their clothes in one of these rooms and changed into white underclothes only. They were then taken to the death cell and shot in the back of the neck with a .38 automatic. A doctor then signed the death certificate, the last document to be put in their files, and the tarpaulin on the floor was taken away to be cleaned by a woman specially. 252. Employed for that purpose. Execution with a small bore pistol is not, as might seem, very humane. Of the 9,432 corpses exhumed at Vinnytsia, 6,360 had needed a second shot, 78, a third shot, and two, a fourth shot, while many others had been struck over the head with some blunt object to finish them off. Again, we are told in a recent Soviet article that in the mass graves at Kuropaty the sand thrown above a new batch of those executed could still be seen moving some time later. At the Lefortovo, the corpses were cremated, and other crematoria seem also to have been used. A tombstone to ashes of unknown persons recently noted at the Danilovsky Monastery is believed to cover some who were executed and never identified. Elsewhere in Moscow, at the Kolevnikovsky Cemetery in the heart of the city, there was what has now been described in the Soviet press as Moscow's Babi Yar, where naked bodies were brought in carts in the middle of the night during the 30s, with rags stopping the two bullet holes in their heads. The final documents in a case were a note to the sanitary burial services of the NKVD, please take 6, 12, or some such a number of corpses, date, signature, and on the other side, 6, 12, or some such a number of corpses cremated, date and signature of the director of the crematorium. This refers to important cases, not to those merely shot and buried in mass. 256. Graves. And so it was elsewhere. In Gorky, for example, during the height of the purge, one estimate is that from 50 to 70 executed corpses were taken out daily from the NKVD headquarters on Vorobivka Street. One prisoner was employed to whitewash the walls of the cells of executed prisoners immediately after they were taken to the NKVD headquarters for execution. This was to cover the names that they had scratched on the 257 walls. As I write, mass execution sites are known in several places, the one in Vinnytsia, discovered by the Germans in 1943, where over 9,000 corpses were exhumed, even though part of the area remained uninvestigated, one between Khabarovsk and Vladivostok, where some 50,000 seem to have been executed in 1937 and 1938, one at Gorno-Altaysk, one at Bykovnya, near Kiev, one, with over 46,000 bodies, near Leningrad, one near Tomsk, one close to the well-known Polish gravesite at Kotyn, near Chelyabinsk, near Poltava, in Donetsk, near Voronezh, and, above all, the mass grave at Kuropaty, near Minsk, of which much was written in the Soviet press in 1988 and 1989, which became the eponym of the later discoveries and where no fewer than 50,000 victims lie buried, while considerably higher estimates have been given in the Soviet press. These included many from newly annexed Western Belorussia in 1939 to 1941. Five of the eight mass graves actually dug up were of Western Belorussians, and three were from 1937 and 1938, though this may not be representative. The total in any case is unexpectedly large, especially when five more sites are reported waiting investigation in or near Minsk alone, with others in the Belorussian provincial capitals. And Belorussia had in 1937, 1938 about 1/30, or 3.4%, of the Soviet population, and even in 1939 to 1941 only about 1/18, or 5.6%. The great majority of the 259 dead were peasants and workers. So the purge had gone on, striking further and further into every layer of the population until finally it reached the mass of the peasantry and the ordinary workers, often accessories in sabotage cases. Although many at this level were shot, most escaped. With a simple confession that, for purposes of counter-revolutionary agitation, they had alleged that there was a shortage of certain foods or of petrol, that shoes manufactured in Soviet factories were of inferior quality, or something of a kind. This was sufficient for a sentence of from 3 to 7 years forced labor under Article 58. Registered. Many accounts by former prisoners contain stories like the following. In September 1937, several hundred peasants were suddenly brought into Kharkov prison. None of the officials in the prison knew what they had been arrested for, so they were beaten up to produce some sort of confession. But the peasants did not know either. Finally, a case was put together. The charges against them were relatively light. Most of them were merely asked to confess that they had carried on counter-revolutionary agitation and sabotage. They had planned to poison wells and burn down barns, and they had put a spell on Stalin and agitated against grain collections. all mere bagatelles. But about 20 of them were in more serious trouble. They were accused of a plot to steal horses, ride into the nearest town and proclaim an insurrection. The church bells were to ring out, and at that sign the countryside was to rise. Nothing of all this had actually happened. The wells had not been poisoned, the cattle had not been harmed, the barns had not been burned down, the horses had not been stolen, the bells had not rung out, and the countryside had not risen. The whole thing was a complete invention. For the remainder of the Azov period, they dominated the prison. They came in groups almost identically composed. First, the chairman of the collective farm was arrested. He would give the names of his committee as accomplices, and they would name their foreman, who would involve the ordinary peasants. Peasants usually confessed as soon as they found out what was required of them. The NKVD at this stage let them know what was needed informally through its own stool pigeons. They went off to the camps in the far north in batches twice a week. Even out on the far Soviet periphery, a British observer, then in Lankaran, Azerbaijan, saw lorry following lorry at intervals throughout the day, filled with Turkic peasants under NKVD escort. Ships, including passenger boats taken off their ordinary routes for the purpose, were waiting to take them across the Caspian. Already in the summer of 1937, a later Soviet writer notes the tremendous scale of the operation. All the agencies were inhumanly overworked. People were run off their feet, transport was insufficient, cells were crowded to bursting, courts sat 24 hours a day. An NKVD officer arrested in November 1938 said that for 6 months it had become clear to the NKVD that the purge could not go on in its present form. The NKVD by now had files proving that almost every leading official everywhere was a spy. Many of them were never arrested. An example is Professor Bogomolets, at the time of his death president of the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences. At least 10 statements from arrested scientists were on the record involving him as a fascist spy. Trademark. The snowball system had reached a stage where half the urban population were down on the NKVD lists. They could not all be arrested, and there was no particular reason to take one rather than another. All the old categories had been largely liquidated: former partisans, old Bolsheviks, oppositionists, and so on. The new arrests in the NKVD itself were a sign that this was understood. The feeling also got around that a vast number of people had been arrested quite indiscriminately, and now they don't even know what to do with them. Not less than 5% of the population had been arrested by the time of Yuzhov's fall, that is, already at least 1 in 20. One can virtually say that every other family in the country on average must have had one of its members in jail. The proportions were far higher among the educated classes. In 1938, even from Stalin's point of view, the whole thing had become impossible. The first substantial question an interrogator asked was, "Who are your accomplices?" So from each arrest, several other arrests more or less automatically followed. But if this had gone on for a few more months, and each new victim named only two or three accomplices, the next wave would have struck at 10-15% of the population, and soon after that at 30-45%. There are many theories of Stalin's motives throughout the whole horrible business, and the question of why he stopped the mass terror at this stage has puzzled many commentators. But we can see that the extreme limits had been reached. To have gone on would have been impossible economically, politically, and even physically, in that interrogators, prisons, and camps, already grotesquely overloaded, could not have managed it. And meanwhile, the work of the mass purge had been done. The country was crushed. 10. On the cultural front. Mendelstam always said that they always knew what they were doing. The aim was to destroy not only people, but the intellect itself. Nadezhda Mendelstam. The Russian intelligentsia had for over a century been the traditional repository of the ideas of resistance to despotism and, above all, to thought control. It was natural that the purge struck at it with particular force. The communists not only took seriously the whole principle of right and wrong ideas, and the necessity of crushing the latter, but also increasingly developed theories of form and method within the arts and sciences, so that someone otherwise an orthodox party man in every way could yet hold opinions in biology or dramatic production which would lead directly to his fall. In Soviet conditions, the academic world overlapped that of government to a larger degree than was then common elsewhere. The economists had been involved in the State Planning Commission, and had mostly been purged in the early 1930s. But in other spheres, too, such as foreign affairs and culture, there was a considerable overlap. We hear of a professor in the Foreign Affairs Commissariat appealing to Molotov to intercede for his father, arrested through what he took to be a misunderstanding. Molotov minuted, to Yuzhov, "Can it be that this professor is still in the People's Commissariat of Foreign Affairs and not in the NKVD?" Whereupon the writer of the letter was unlawfully arrested. During March, April, and May 1937, articles appeared attacking deviation in history and economics, and among the cadres of literature. A special article by Molotov sharpened the tone of the campaign. Historians were particularly vulnerable. The whole school of party historians which had followed Pokrovsky were arrested. They were often labeled terrorists. In fact, it is extraordinary how many of the leading terrorist bands were headed by historians. Sokolnikov mentioned in the most natural way at his trial that arrests had begun among the historians. Prigozhin, one of the leading terrorist executives of the group then before the court, was a historian. So were Karev, Seidel, Anishev, Vanag, Zaks Gladnev, Pyatkovsky, and Friedland, named at the 1936 and 1937 trials as active terrorists. Friedland is mentioned by Roddick as leading a terror group actually consisting of historians, this we, among ourselves, called the historical or hysterical group. Professors were a convenient class of suspect because they were in a position to recruit plausible terrorists in the persons of students, also a much arrested class. It was said in evidence at the 1937 trial, as a normal thing, that the terrorist organization in Siberia sought its cadres chiefly among the young people in the universities. Friedland and the others were party historians and automatically involved in controversy. But the non-party academic world was also in a difficult position. While the man in the street could cease to talk a great deal, the professors were bound to continue giving lectures before public audiences, which inevitably contained informers on the alert for anything which could possibly be interpreted as hostile. Colleagues, too, might be serving the police. A successful and erudite professor in Dnipropetrovsk, who had matters in his past which the NKVD used against him, is described as a most efficient agent provocateur. F. A professor of ancient history, Konstantin Stepa, first lost favor as a result of describing Joan of Arc as high-strung. Joan had been treated in a hostile fashion or ignored until the mid-1930s, but with the coming of the Popular Front in France she had been referred to as a heroine of a national resistance movement, so that the professor's remarks deviated from the party line. After considerable trouble about this, he was again censured for a reference to the legend of Midas in an unfortunate context. Then, speaking of ancient and Christian demonology, he happened to remark that country people are always backward. Unfortunately, Trotsky, like many others, had expressed the same thought. Finally, in dealing with the Donatist movement in North Africa, at the time of the Roman Empire, he had shown that it was in part a national as well as a peasant rebellion, thus becoming a bourgeois nationalist. At this time, in 1937, his friends and colleagues were being arrested on a large scale. I was naturally sorry for my friends, but I was not only sorry for them. I was also afraid of them. After all, they could say things about conversations we had had, in which we had not always expressed the orthodox view. There had been nothing criminal in these conversations, they had contained no attacks on the Soviet power. But the trivial criticisms and grumbles and expressions of resentment and disappointment which occurred in every conversation forced every Soviet citizen to feel guilty. Then came the suicide of Leshenko and his wife, Anne Krupnik. Unfortunately, the wife had been a university lecturer, and the whole staff of Kiev University naturally became high-grade suspects. A vast network of bourgeois nationalists in the universities and cultural agencies came to light. Nevertheless, the professor was not arrested until March 1938. After a severe interrogation for 50 days, by a series of 13 magistrates, he was charged with complicity in an attempt to assassinate Kosyr. The fall of Kosyr led to the withdrawal of this charge in his and many other cases, and for it was substituted espionage for Japan. This was based on the following facts: the professor had for some time been head of the Byzantological Committee of the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences. The term then came to be regarded as reactionary and was replaced by Near East. This connection with the East was regarded as adequate for at least some suspicion of sympathy with, and espionage for, a country a good deal farther east. It was shown that the professor had lectured on Alexander the Great and Hannibal to senior Red Army officers. This had given him contact with the army and therefore the opportunity to carry out espionage. It was then proved that he had actually met foreigners in the person of Professor Harani, the great specialist in Hittite history, who had recruited him through another Byzantologist who had lectured in the Soviet Far East, thus getting very near Japan. Finally, an indirect contact was found with a professor in Odessa who had actually met the Japanese consul there. The reports passed through this espionage link to Tokyo consisted of remarks about the political morale of the army, and here a genuine fact was established in that the accused had once told a colleague that some senior officers have confused Napoleon III with Napoleon I, and Alexander the Great with Caesar. When things became easier, after Yazhov's fall, Some of the surviving academics withdrew their confessions, the charges began to be toned down, and eventually, in the early autumn of 1939, the professor was released. He was lucky. Others were still going, from V.G. Sorin, of the Institute of Red Professors, repressed as an enemy of the people in 1939, who died in prison. Or Kampe in 1944, degree down to non-party lecturers. Sorin is said to have been willing to supply Stalin with suitable texts, but he drew the line at inventing texts and falsifying quotations. At the February, March 1937 plenum, Zhdanov had complained that of the 183 members of the Institute of Red Professors, 32 had been arrested between 1933 and 1936, and 53 more had more recently been found to be enemies of the people. At a party meeting in a university, where a member was denounced with the approval of the chair, it sometimes happened that a supporter would rise and ask for proof of the charges against his colleague. The makers of such demands were invariably denounced for counter-revolutionary attitudes, always silenced, and often arrested. At a meeting of the Kiev Academy of Sciences, for example, someone denounced Professor Koperyshinsky. Another communist scientist, Kaminsky, not the Minister of Health, remarked, "Where class instinct speaks, proof is unnecessary." He, too, was later arrested. The secretary of the academy was publicly accused in the local press of having demanded proof about a similar denunciation. He was one of the 13 successive secretaries of the academy between 1921 and 1938, all of whom were arrested. Of the seven principals of Kiev University in the same period, six were arrested and one died a natural death. In the Belarusian Academy of Sciences, too, a center for the espionage work of enemies of the people was discovered, including most of those in leading positions. 37 names are listed for 8 institutes. The Academy of Sciences covers a wide range of disciplines. But we should note that the purge was violent not only among Byzantologists and so on, whom a technologically minded state can perhaps do without at a pinch, but also among scientists proper. The physicist Weisberg describes the situation at the Kharkov Physics Institute. "Listen," I said. "Our institute is one of the most important of its kind in Europe. In fact, there is probably no other institute with so many different and well-equipped laboratories. The Soviet government has spared no expense. Our leading scientists were partly trained abroad. They were constantly being sent to leading physicists all over the world at government expense to supplement their knowledge and experience. Our institute had 8 departments, each headed by a capable man. And what's the situation now? The head of the laboratory for crystallography, Obramoy, is under arrest, and so is the head of the low-temperature laboratory, Shubnikov. The head of the second low-temperature laboratory, Ruhmann, has been deported. The head of the laboratory for atom splitting, Lyapunsky, is under arrest, and so are the head of the Röntgen department, Gorsky, the head of the department for theoretical physics, Landau, and the head of the experimental low-temperature station, myself. As far as I know, Slutsky, the head of the ultra-shortwave department, is the only one still at work. Amongst those arrested is the founder of the institute, Professor Obramov, its first director. Professor Lyapunsky, member of the Academy of Sciences and later again director of the institute. Professor Lev Davidovich Landau, the leading theoretical physicist in the Soviet Union. At Landau had already been forced out of the institute by the GPU, and he went to Moscow to work with Professor Kapitsa. "I supervised the building of our low-temperature experimental station, but before it could be put into operation I was arrested. My successor was Komarov. He has also been arrested. Who is to carry on? You need 5 years to train an engineer, and even then the government had a very great deal of trouble before it could get suitable engineers for its new factories. But a capable physicist needs from 10 to 15 years training. Matvey Bronstein, a brilliant young physicist, was married to the writer Lydia Chukovskaya. He was arrested and shot on February 18, 1938. She then wrote the story Sofia Petrovna, which only appeared in Russia in 1988, in the Leningrad magazine Nova. She had actually read it to Anna Akhmatova and 8 others, who agreed that it could not be kept in the flat of the wife of an enemy of the people. And the NKVD, in fact, soon heard rumors and searched her place. A friend took it, but died in the siege of Leningrad. Before dying, however, he dragged himself to his sister's to give her the manuscript to keep. After the war, the sister kept it, by arrangement with Chukovskaya, until she died in 1956. Then, after the dead woman's belongings were dispersed, Chukovskaya finally found it in the bottom of a dust-covered waste paper basket. Few such documents, for the story is factual, survive. It might have been published in Khrushchev's time, but she refused to change a word. The purge also extended into the more technical sciences. For example, academician Berg writes. Thereafter there came difficult times, 1937, the loss of one's close friends. Soon I too was arrested on a basis of a ridiculous and stupid denunciation. I spent precisely 900 days in prison. I was let out shortly before the war. During these years radio technology suffered an enormous loss. Institutes and laboratories were closed down and people disappeared. Sergei Korolev, the unique genius behind the Soviet early space program, was sent to Kolyma, but eventually brought to the NKVD prison aviation group Kosos near the Yauza River. He had been told that our country doesn't need your fireworks. Or maybe you're making rockets for an attempt on the life of our leader? He was contemptuous of the regime, and fully expected to be shot. The aircraft designer Ayan Tupolev was arrested on October 21, 1937. He was kept standing for many hours on end. Since I am a heavy man it was rather tough. But on the advice of Mukhlevich, who was one of his cellmates, he confessed before worse befell him. His wife was also arrested. The charge was of having sold plans to the Germans for use on the Messerschmitt 109. The aviator Levinsky had a couple of years earlier denounced him to Stalin as a wrecker. In November 1938, Tupolev withdrew some of his testimony, and in the following years asserted his innocence in several appeals. He finally only got a 10-year sentence. He was later, foreign policy having changed, accused of being a French spy, but was in fact released in 1941. He had meanwhile worked, with other scientists, in one of the NKVD's prisoner research units, of the type described in the first circle. Another aircraft designer, Tchaikovsky, was also arrested. His wife, arrested too, was one day given her clothes, taken to a manicurist and hairdresser, and told she was to meet her husband, but must not let him know that she, too, was in jail. He was reassured, and told her that he could now do the technical work they were giving him in the Lubyanka with an easy mind. However, he seems to have been shot later, as were most of the leading figures in the aircraft industry. Generally speaking, the sciences in some way connected with policy or ideology fared worst. Sciences impinging on agriculture fared badly on both counts. The Meteorological Office was violently purged as early as 1933, for failing to predict weather harmful to the crops. In part on similar grounds, astronomers connected with sunspot research fared badly. The Solar Service had in fact been set up in 1931 to help predict long-range weather patterns, with the usual imperfect results, though there were also charges of un-Marxist theories of sunspot development. But astronomy in general suffered a devastating purge, conducted by the Stalinist pseudo-astronomer Taro Genezov. This started in early 1936, and soon the press was attacking the Great Pilkovo Observatory, which had in its earlier days been known as the astronomical capital of the world. The distinguished astronomer B.V. Numerov, arrested in November, admitted after severe beatings that he had organized a counter-revolutionary astronomers group for espionage, terror, and wrecking. It had drawn a significant number of scientific workers into its orbit. In all, about 27 astronomers, mostly leading figures, disappeared between 1936 and 1938. Work at Pulkovo almost ceased, and the observatories at Tashkent and elsewhere also suffered severely. Russian astronomy, which had led the world, was devastated. It is curious to recall that Stalin's own first job was at an observatory. Biology was, of course, a particularly sensitive field. With the rise of Lysenko in the early 1930s, a fierce ideological struggle commenced. Already in 1932, G. A. Levitsky and N. P. Avdolov, cytologists, were arrested, but were later released. Other biologists were arrested about the same time. In December 1936, the more prominent Professor I. J. Egel was arrested on charges of Trotskyism and was executed. Professor S. G. Levitt, head of the Medico-Genetic Institute, was expelled from the party on the grounds that his biological views were pro-Nazi. The People's Commissar for Health, G. M. Kaminsky, was also criticized for defending him. Levitt was arrested in about May 1937 and died in prison. A number of other prominent biologists, such as Levitsky, Karpchenko, and Govorov, also perished, as did the celebrated N. M. Tulekov, director of the Cereals Institute, who was arrested in 1937 and died in 1938 in one of the White Sea labor camps. The botanist A. Yanata was shot, on June 8, 1938, for having proposed chemicals to destroy weeds, contrary to the urging of Lysenkoites. Max Levin, former head of the 1919 Bavarian Soviet Republic, seems also to have perished in his biological rather than his political capacity. In this field, as in the political, the lesser figures were arrested first, and the net thus closed round their superiors. The biggest game was academician N.I. Vavilov, the great geneticist, Lenin's favorite. He had given up his position as head of the Lenin All-Union Academy of Agricultural Sciences in 1935 to A.I. Muralov, until then deputy commissar for agriculture. Muralov was arrested on July 4, 1937 and succeeded by Professor G.K. Meister. Meister was, in turn, arrested at the beginning of 1938, and Lysenko took the job after a squalid and deadly intrigue. Vavilov himself was in trouble early in 1940 for some argument about the right agricultural policy to pursue in the parts annexed from Finland. An open quarrel with Lysenko followed. In August, he was touring the Ukraine. While in Cernavodi, he was suddenly recalled to Moscow, and arrested on 6 August. The files on his case, to which leading biologists were given access after the fall of Lysenko in 1964, contain a letter from Beria to Molotov as Politburo member in charge of science, requesting permission for this arrest. Vavilov was under interrogation for 11 months and was questioned over 100 times. He was tried on July 9, 1941 by the military collegium on charges of rightist conspiracy, espionage for England, and other matters. He was sentenced to death. The veteran biologist Ian Pryanisnikov, together with Vavilov's physicist brother, had interviews with Beria and Molotov to try to have him released, but without success. Pryanisnikov also seems to have intervened through Beria's wife to try to get better prison conditions for his old colleague, and he even had the extraordinary temerity to nominate Vavilov for a Stalin Prize in 1941. Vavilov was now held in Saratov prison. He introduced himself to his cellmates, "You see before you, talking of the past, academician Vavilov, but now, according to the opinion of the investigators, nothing but dung." Held in the condemned cell, a windowless underground block, without any exercise, for nearly a year, he was almost saved by his election in 1942 as a Fellow of the Royal Society in London, and his sentence was commuted to 20 years. But it was too late. Dystrophy had gone too far, he was a goner and died on January 26, 1943. His wife and son had been evacuated from Leningrad to Saratov in 1942 and lived all this time within a few miles of the prison where he was dying. But they were informed that he was in Moscow and did not learn of his presence. The triumph of Lysenkoism was the most extraordinary of all the indications of the intellectual degeneracy of the party mind which had followed on Stalin's replacement of the intellectual section of the apparatus by his own creatures, such as Mitin and Meklis, in the early 1930s. The villain of the piece from this point of view was the charlatan I present, who established the orthodoxy of the Lysenko line by a complex and superficially sophisticated manipulation of the Marxist phraseology. To do justice to Zhdanov, he at least was never wholly taken in by Lysenko, and the final destruction of Soviet biology was only accomplished in 1948, as part and parcel of his own political defeat and death. But meanwhile, impressive verbalization, backed by vicious intrigue, secured Lysenko's position of supremacy even if not yet of monopoly. Another field in which a wholly erroneous doctrine was declared orthodox was linguistics. By the late 1920s, the teachings of N. Marr, who held that all language derives from the four sounds rush, sal, burr, and yawn, became accepted as the Marxist line. It is a view otherwise universally dismissed. As a result, old professors first were exiled, later had their books withdrawn, and in 1937 and 1938 were usually arrested. A major case was that of Professor E. D. Polyevanov, a friend of Mayakovsky, arrested in 1937 and shot on January 25, 1938. Tilda, Stalin abandoned Marxism in 1950, censuring its adherents for having bullied the anti-Marxists. This was followed by the Dictionary affair, about which little is known except that the French writer Romain Rolland managed to get the sentences commuted to imprisonment. But the heaviest toll of all seems to have been among the writers. They were threatened from two directions. A theory of correct aesthetic method was imposed on them, and at the same time the content of their works was subject to intense scrutiny. It emerged in the 1950s that of the 700 writers who met at the first Congress of the Union of Soviet Writers in 1934, only 50 survived to see the second in 1954. A recent estimate is that 90% of the membership was repressed. After the 20th Party Congress in 1956, it was confidentially admitted that there were more than 600 writers who were guilty of no crime, and whom the Union of Writers obediently left to their fate in the prisons and camps. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, telling of this, adds that in reality the list is still longer. And the Soviet researcher Edward Beltov has lately revealed that he has long collected a list of a number of writers verified as dead in the repressions, though this also includes the post-1938 purges. He has the names of nearly 1,300. But he adds that this is incomplete, that Vasil Bykov, in his capacity as a deputy in the Belarusian Supreme Soviet, recently applied to that body's presidium for information on several dozen Belarusian writers who disappeared at this time, and that the local law enforcement authorities had no information about 18 of those names. In the country as a whole, about 150 literators, including some 75 members of the Union of Soviet Writers, could not be traced at all. In all, the organ of the Union now tells us, some 2,000 literary figures were repressed, of whom about 1,500 met their deaths in prison or camp. In connection with the Zinoviev trial in August 1936, a series of hysterical articles in La Tiridnaya Gazeta attacked Trotskyite writers. They had infiltrated the writers' union apparatus. Numbers of well-known authors were denounced, including Aya Katov, who had allegedly received Trotskyite directives in 1928, sent money to Trotskyites then in internal exile, and retained his ties with Trotsky, Tarasov Rodionov, who also for years had ties with class enemies, and Galina Serebryakova, married in turn to Sokol Nikifin Serebrokov. She survived years in camp, but the others did not. At the same time, the periodical attacked scores of other enemy writers throughout the Soviet Union. The spring of 1937, in part in connection with Yagoda's fall, saw the end of the former Russian Association of Proletarian Writers, RAPP, which had bullied the writing community from an extreme Marxist position in the early 1930s before being repudiated by Stalin in 1932 in favor of socialist realism. L. Averbakh, its leading figure, was a relative of Yagoda by marriage and was denounced as a Trotskyite and arrested in mid-April, together with the playwright V. Kershin, a delegate to the 17th Party Congress, who was eventually shot in the political, military massacre at the end of July 1938. Dmitry Mirsky, a prince who had fought in the White Army, had been converted to communism while in exile in England, and had returned to the USSR, was now referred to by La Tiridnaya Gazeta as that filthy rangelist and White Guard officer. Registered the leading Polish communist poet, Bruno Jasienski, was also denounced in connection with the rapists. At his first interrogation in the Lefortovo, the examiner seized him by his shoulders and stamped on his feet. He was, of course, accused as a Polish spy, in connection with the case of T.F. Dombel, shot on December 4, 1938. He was given a 15-year sentence as such, but also as a French spy. A friend met him in the Tyarichka camp near Vladivostok, now barely recognizable from sickness, hunger, and exhaustion, but denied entry to the hospital, though he was apparently admitted before he died in 1939. There were certain definite grudges to be paid off. Isaac Babel, Russia's finest short story writer, had served in Badeni's cavalry army in the Civil War in the Polish campaign, and in 1924 published his extraordinary collection of Civil War stories, Konarmia. Badeni had protested vigorously as each vignette forming the book came out. He regarded the ruthlessly clear-eyed stories as a slander, preferring the hack heroics of the ordinary correspondents. Gorky, recognizing Babel's very different talent, had protected him. Babel wrote of the revolution, "It's eaten with gunpowder and the very best blood is poured over it." It was Babel who at the Writers' Congress of 1934 had spoken of the heroism of silence, a phrase and an activity to be condemned bitterly as a sign of alienation from the regime. Babel knew Yazhov's wife. Although he knew it was unwise, he sometimes went to see her to find a key to the puzzle. He gathered that whatever Yazhov's role, it was not at the bottom of it. He ceased to be published in 1937 and at the end of May 1939 was arrested in his dacha at the writers' settlement at Perodelkino. He is said to have resisted arrest and was shot on January 27, 1940, a week before Meyerhold, whose case was connected with his. Babel, in addition to offending a minor figure like Badeni and bringing into disrepute the 1st Cavalry Army, from which Stalin was now drawing an inadequate substitute for a high command, is said to have made a rash joke about the general secretary. But his offense was small compared with that of Boris Pilnyak, another talent to have arisen from the revolution. His Naked Year, about a provincial town in 1919, is a most extraordinary representation, in which the struggle for bare existence brings out the excess, the eccentricity, of the range of Russian character. As early as the 1920s, Pilnyak had become involved in one of the most obscure and doubtful crimes attributed to Stalin. In the spring of 1924, Frunze was appointed deputy commissar for war, and in practice took over control of the army, with little resistance from Trotsky, before Trotsky's actual removal in 1925. He seems to have sympathized mainly with the Zinoviev-Kamenev group. In the late summer of 1925, he fell ill, and died on 31st of October of that year. The rumor in Moscow was that he had been ordered by the Central Committee, that is, in effect, by Stalin, to undergo